Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. In this episode, my guest is Warren Brush, a permaculture teacher and designer who, along with his wife, operates Quail Springs in California as a permaculture demonstration site and education center. His experiences and connections in the permaculture community have taken him all over the world as a teacher and consultant. However, this time around, it is not his travels that we speak about. Rather, after an introduction and discussion of his background, which includes taking his permaculture design course with Bill Mollison, we spend the bulk of our time together talking about opportunities and models for making permaculture profitable by moving beyond the backyards and byways to broad-scale, sustainable agriculture, financed by community and slow money investment. Along the way, numerous books and individuals are mentioned. You will find a complete list of everything I could catch in the show notes at thepermaculturepodcast.com. While you're there, you can leave a comment about the show. And if you would like to contact me about this or any other episode, that address is show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or you can call the voicemail line, 717-827-6266. I hope you enjoy this time with Warren as much as I did. Now on to the interview. So why don't you give us a little bit of your background and how you came to permaculture, and we can go from there.
Okay, great. Well, I'm really glad to be here today, and my background is one of a lot of diversity. In itself, it's not a path that was directly started from birth right into permaculture. I've had a very circuitous journey to get here. I've had everything in my life from being at a very young age, at 19 years old, I was a business owner, to working for a travel magazine, to a very formidable time when I was working while I was going to college with autistic children, who really reconnected a lot of my awareness to my connections to nature. And as that started to unfold, I started to get into animal tracking, and I started to learn about survival skills, and started to look at the patterns that exist in nature as a way of reading a different language that actually exists in the landscape. And that led to my first organization that I founded with my wife, Cindy, was an organization called Wilderness Youth Project in Santa Barbara, California, which is one of the top youth organizations in Central California. There's about 1,200 kids a year go through these programs that we started, and started that program working specifically with homeless children. And as we started to do this for many years, we started to get kids who were younger, who, as they got to age of becoming an adult, they were like, wow, you know, we've learned how to, you know, we've learned and we've developed this stewardship ethic of wanting to take care of the earth, but how do we bring that from the wilderness back into our daily life? How do we live that? You know, there's not a lot of education programs, there's not a lot of examples of people living a stewardship lifestyle, a regenerative lifestyle. So that really, for my wife and I, was a big impetus for us to start to look and say, well, wow, what could we offer now to kids that have grown up in being able to take that stewardship ethic and involve it in their life? And that led to the development of Quail Springs. And when we started Quail Springs about 9 years ago, we started to look around to see who were the elders in regenerative living. And of course, what came up was permaculture, and that there was this understanding, this body of knowledge that looked and respected and honored indigenous understanding and the pattern recognition skills of indigenous peoples, and how that stewardship ethic was directly linked to your awareness of the patterns that are in the world around you. And we said, whoa, wait a minute, this just fits perfectly with our work we're doing with kids in animal tracking and the origin skills type stuff that we were doing. And so that, you know, got me started with permaculture. And as I started to look into it, I said, well, I want to go and learn from the best. So I went down and learned from Bill Mollison himself in Australia, and Jeff Lawton, and, you know, began what I would never have anticipated was a career in being a permaculture teacher and designer, and one of the people in the movement that's very active all over the world. So it's been quite a journey, and a lot of it just comes back to really my desire for a healthy earth and for healthy people. And I realize the earth doesn't need us. You know, it can shake us off in in a heartbeat if she chooses to. And it's something where I realize that a lot of the work has to do with people, because you can have the presence of shelter, water, fire, and food and all around you. But if a healthy social structure isn't there, you can still have war. So I'm realizing that it's an important part of this journey in permaculture is really that care of the people piece. And that's been a lot of my focus, is blending the care of the earth piece with the care of the people piece.
There's an idea that comes up in my work with permaculture is the four Fs, that we need food, fuel, fiber, and fun in order to make this work.
Yeah. There's also times where you get asked to do things that aren't so fun, but that they're deeply satiating. Like, I don't believe that we follow our bliss. I have a real hard time with that, because I feel that there are times you're asked to do stuff that is not like the thing that you would love to be doing at that moment, but it's really what the world needs. So I find that for me, living a deeply satiating life, and that having a vision for my life that is a point on the horizon that I can point to, but I never get there, because the closer I get to that point, I realize it's just a beacon on the distance that I'm heading toward. And so I realize for me, it's something that, you know, it's important to find other people who are also heading in the same direction. And then we can tie our canoes together and head in that direction. But nobody has to live my vision, and I don't have to live anybody else's vision or gifts. So it's great. So like, each of us has a different way of expressing that. And I really, that's one of the things that I mentor with all the young people that I'm working with, is how to be unique in your gift, and how to, you know, whether you're working in permaculture or, you know, however your life is expressing itself, that you actually are a part of a bigger plan, that you're a piece in the puzzle in the ecology of the unfolding of the world and of life, and that you have a gift that no one in the history of humanity has ever seen, or in the future of all humanity, no one will ever see that. And when you express that gift, you make the world more whole. So our goal as a community of people is to help each other find those gifts. And that's one of those things that is at the very core of my work in permaculture.
Can I ask you one question? It's just a quick aside before we continue with this.
Sure.
You say you went to Australia to learn from Mollison and Lawton.
Yeah.
What was it like to study with Bill? I get that question a lot, because he hasn't been teaching as much in the past couple of years, so it always comes up.
Yeah, well, I actually taught with him in Jordan back in September. I did a course with him, which was really, really fun to actually have been his student and now to be in a classroom teaching a course with him and have him sitting there while I'm teaching. And, you know, one of the things is that he's a thorny pioneer. Very importantly so. He's got a fire around him of that he brings people to their edge. And so depending on how people react when they're at their edge in that little zone where it's uncomfortable and there's a lot of energy moving in, if they're not comfortable with that, they'll see him as an asshole. If they are comfortable with that in themselves, they'll realize that he's someone that'll help you grow further into your edges. And if you look at systems theory, you'll realize that, you know, in systems theory, it talks about how all new energy enters through the edge. So he pushes you to become a vehicle of new energy entering into the system wherever you are. And that's what it took for him and a lot of the other pioneer species within the movement to actually get this movement out and around the world in a way that it is today. You'll see I have no quick answers. I'm a storyteller, Scott, so bear with me.
No, that's okay. There are those ideas of the three C's in presentations: concise, clear, and correct.
Yeah.
And I always have to remind myself of that, because I wind up being asked a question. It's like, well, let's start in the beginning. And usually it's, you know, the dinosaurs before we get to the present to get to a point. So that's quite all right.
And in storytelling, you're constantly linking things in the past with the things now, with things in the future. So, I mean, a good storyteller, you'll be telling a story from 1,000 years ago, but the story ends today, that you saw somebody from the story out in the street down from Starbucks, you know? And that's how traditional storytelling is.
One of the topics that I had for us was, since we've touched on storytelling, is how do you use storytelling in your teaching of this material to others?
That's a great question. If you look at how the intrinsic characteristics of any species of animal, any species of anything that lives out in the world, that you'll find that they develop in response to their environment through very long periods of time. And when you look at humans, one of the things that you can conjecture is that we have developed over many, many millennia, and storytelling has been a part of our development. We are literally hardwired to learn through the storytelling process, because, and the way I know that is that you can find every single traditional culture that is around the world has a storytelling tradition, an oral tradition. And so that tells us something that's innate around, you know, the common pattern that exists in all people tells us that we're actually hardwired for it. And I find that when you are able to blend, like for me, I have a science background from college, but I have had some incredible elders in my life who are some from indigenous cultures, some not from indigenous cultures, who have really shared the power of storytelling. I also come from a family of storytellers. My mom and dad were puppeteers, and so I grew up with them telling stories through puppets. And for me, that was a powerful medium because they were, you know, sharing a body, you know, if they had like a message they were trying to bring through, they always brought it through stories. And for me, what I've found as a permaculture teacher is that it's like a pulse when you're teaching. You give some information and then you contextualize it in a story. And I find that students that you have a broad range of different learning styles that all your students have. If you have 60 students in a course, you're going to have a broad diversity of learning styles. But that innately human part of us learns well from having some detailed focus and then having a contextualized story around it. And I find that that ends up becoming a really good tool to actually set the information in a place that it, you know, gives it very fertile ground for the seeds that are being planted during a course to germinate.
If someone wanted to integrate storytelling into their teaching methods, or even just to learn storytelling as an art to improve their own interaction with others, are there any resources or methods that you would recommend to someone?
I think that's interesting. There's a difference between some of the kind of perceptions of what storytelling is, where people are used to being, where they see it as entertainment. And I don't know if you've had that too, or, you know, most people see storytelling as just another form of artistic expression. And what I'm talking about with storytelling is this weaving of experience and how you express that weaving of experiences through your own life to help to bring together a more holistic view of the world around you. So if you're trying to teach about gray water systems and you can tell a story that comes from your own life where you talk about your discovery of, you know, what a gray water is and how, you know, or like for me when I worked in Liberia that, you know, I realized that the gray water was actually causing malaria in this particular housing area where there were all these former child soldiers from the Liberian War were living there, rehabilitating and learning some peacemaking skills, and also came and I was brought in to teach permaculture. But what was happening was everybody was sick. And so when I came in, the first thing I did is I looked for vectors of disease, and I started to look around and I found with my nose that something was amiss. And as I sniffed out this water that was rancid or that was anaerobic, I realized that all their gray water was going into this pit. And the pit was filled with the mosquito larvae that were squiggling around through the water. And I realized that this one area was probably transferring that malaria through the group. And so the first thing I did was I went to the grandmothers of the group and I said, you know, how is it that you get your water? And they told us how they had to walk this great distance to get their water on their heads. And I said, well, what if we can make that 50 liters of water you're carrying on your head into 100 liters? Rather than just saying gray water, I said, you know, let's try to make better use of that water that's so difficult to get, and we'll bring it in. And what we'll do is you'll use it for everything you're doing, but instead of throwing it out and causing malaria, you know, or helping the disease foster itself in that region, let's actually turn it into a gray water system. And then lo and behold, we built a banana circle, and within 1 year, they had the most prolific food system without changing a single pattern. So when you start to talk about gray water, and I wanted to illustrate it because that itself, you can talk about stories or you can feel it in your bones by having a story weave itself around you and into your life. And so, you know, now when you hear with that, when somebody says gray water, you've got this story of Liberia in you and how it linked to malaria, and there was this, you know, this unfolding that happened. And I find that it's a way of hydrating ideas within somebody through connection rather than a disassociated kind of didactic way that our modern education system uses, where it says, here, you take this, you learn it, but there's no association, no connection. There's no synapses that actually link it to your own story. So that's a part of that power of storytelling. And that's a long way of explaining it, but I hopefully you heard that.
You certainly took me around.
Yeah. Yeah, good.
Coming from a technical background and being very facts and figures oriented, I'm very used to a 1-2-3, 1-2-3 mm-hmm. sometimes. Mm-hmm.
There's a place for that, Scott, too, just so you know that there's a need that you can move between these different ways of seeing. So that's an important skill. There's times where you got to be 1-2-3-4 and you've got to follow that trail because that's what's needed there. But to be stuck in that and apply that everywhere, you know, it's like the person with the hammer sees everything as a nail. So if that's the only way that you approach things, then it could actually be, you know, debilitating in your learning process. So, you know, it's another way of trying to look and be holistic in every part of your life.
So you strive in your teaching then to provide your students and everyone else around you with as large of a toolbox as possible, so they're not just reaching for a hammer?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, there's times a hammer is needed, you know, and there's times, you know, it's like our brains, we have so given our brains control of everything we do, rather than having our brain being one tool in our toolbox. We have our heart, we have our intuition, we have our perception that can be, you know, looked at without judgment. And there's all of these tools that become really important to become solid designers on the landscape, because the land is a dynamic. All of the ecology of the life where we live is this moving, living dynamic that can't be boxed in. It can't be segregated into its pieces and defined and controlled. It's one of those things that is out of our control. And so the more tools we have that are holistic, the more we can actually blend with the landscape. And that may sound, I don't know, the kind of woo-woo to some people, but there's a real, if you talk to like some of the top people in the world who are like Owen Dell, who is he wrote The Dummy's Guide for Sustainable Landscaping and several sustainable landscaping books. He talks about this intuition piece in his designs. He's one of the top landscape designers in the world, and it has to do with blending with that subtle energy that is around us. And when we do that, we move more towards sustainability than if we just impose ourselves on the land and add a lot of green products and call it sustainable. You know, there's a difference between being truly sustainable to being just another shade of green.
You mentioned about not being able to contain all of this. When we think about small solutions within permaculture, and it's that we're making the changes that are necessary to bring about sustainability in our system without trying to fight against it. And that idea of moving water through the landscape, that it continually moves from place to place to place, but eventually it's released from the landscape that we control. We just borrow it for the time that we can before letting it be free. And that having a holistic approach, we're not trying to fence everything in or control it or saying that this is mine and I have to have it now and forever.
Yeah, there's so much in that. That's so true. You know, who owns the water? Does the water own you, or do you own the water? That's the thing that I'm really coming to terms with a lot in my life, is realizing that even the economy that we have out here is owned by the environment. And, you know, if you look at it like that, like, wow, okay, wait a minute. If you track back, every aspect of the economy is dependent upon the suckling of Mother Nature. You know what I mean? Or if you want to put it in a different terms, it's completely dependent on the ecologies that sustain it. And so there's no way to separate out an economy from an ecology. And so when you look at it, though, it's not the economy that owns the ecology. It's ultimately the ecology that owns the economy. So just that mindset changes how you perceive things around you and how you walk on the land and how you design on the land. You know, so many people live their life totally with unconscious design in their life. And it's one of those things where I love that about permaculture, is that they say right up front, you know, it's a conscious design science for sustainable human settlement. You know, that's my elevator answer. Conscious design science for sustainable human settlement. And when you look at that, it's like, wow, okay, so what does conscious design actually mean? And it means having incredible awareness of the patterns that are both big and very subtle on your landscape, from the micro to the macro, that you harmonize with. Because anytime you don't harmonize with an existing natural pattern, it's going to cost you energy. And that's when you start to get down to what is the actual definition of sustainability. And for me, it's that, a system must produce more than it can consume and through good design. And so if you literally bring all of it down to a caloric understanding, you start to realize that you have to harmonize with every aspect of nature as best you can, or it's going to just cost you over the lifetime of that system and very likely not be sustained.
When you combine that with your thought that you can't separate the economy from the ecology, it reinforces the damage that's caused by an extractive economy.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's one of the things that is really a front or an edge for the permaculture movement is to demonstrate how permaculture is a more economically sound way to proceed. And it's really a important place that in the permaculture movement, we have to show how that plays out, because you can see a direct correlation between something being, not costing as much, oftentimes ends up being, and more than not, if you have less money, you're going to make a more ecological sound design. The more money you throw at a design, the more it's generally ends up becoming more extractive. And Art Ludwig of Oasis Design talks a lot about that. He has a book called Integrated Design. I think that's what he calls it. But he talks about the relationship between economics and sustainability. And when projects have a lot of money, they generally move further away from being sustainable. And so it's an important, I think, edge for us as permaculture designers is to look and say, okay, if I could take a farm that is extractive, monocrop farm, and turn it into an ecologically diverse soil building operation that has multiple micro enterprises on that land, and you can show a neighboring farm and the neighboring farmers or the regional farmers the financial viability of being completely and deeply ecological, you'll see a lot more landscapes moving into soil building than if we just proceed as the movement has been doing in people's backyards and a few farms here and there. But we really have to show the economic viability of it right now. I see farmers all over the world, and almost every single larger farmer that I end up, not personally larger, but their farms are large. Everyone that I talk to talks about the debt that they're incurring to be able to maintain their operation. And that has to do because when you have an extractive agriculture, you're constantly pulling from your savings account of soil resources, and eventually you have to keep adding other things to it, so it puts you in debt. I mean, you won't, on a day-to-day, you wouldn't live in a way where you're, every month you're drawing from your savings to live, because at some point you're gonna end up being completely bankrupt. And that's what's happened, is that we're bankrupt on a soil level in all of Western agriculture now, because we've had enough years to where the bank account has been depleted so much that now you're getting collapse of those systems. So basically, the banks are closing the account, so to speak, or the earth is closing its bank account on soil. So it's really a front that we have to push into more, is how to show economic viability, because people will change what they're doing if they can see that it makes more sense for them economically.
The economics of permaculture is a topic that I've run across in both my personal exploration and questions from listeners, because right now when people look at permaculture, what the outside world tends to see is that the only way people who are practicing permaculture seem to be making a living with it is through courses and teaching. And they'll go to a public event where they'll meet some people who are giving a lecture on permaculture, and then it's becomes one of, hey, do you want to come take a PDC? Do you want to take a course? Do you want to do this? Without showing the other sides of it and how this can work beyond just teaching the material. The other thing is that there are only a handful of projects that I've seen that are broad scale, more than, just a couple of acres that a family or a small group is tending.
Yeah.
And you mentioned before we began that you're working on a large project that's going to be a for-profit permaculture project outside of Santa Barbara?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, it's very exciting. This interview is happening 2 days before we close escrow on a 49-acre farm, which isn't that large. You know, you talk to some farmers in Ohio and they'll laugh at 49 acres, you know. It's like how some people laugh at my natural building house because it's only 600 square feet. They don't think it's a real house. But 49 acres is nothing to shake a stick at, so to speak. And if you look statistically, you can make more profit in a 49-acre farm than you can in a 490-acre farm because of the scale of a 490-acre farm is going to be, you're going to have to involve a lot more equipment that puts you either in debt. And you don't actually make more per acre. So under 70 acres, they say you can make the most profit per acre because it's more tendable. And so this, and I haven't actually shared this with a lot of people. We've been keeping it quiet. So this, the timing of this interview is very synchronistic. And we've started a for-profit LLC called Regenerative Earth Farms. It's actually called Regenerative Earth, and then one of our operating names is Regenerative Earth Farms. And we've gathered some incredible people that I've been working with and teaching with, and also students who are very, very interested in taking the things that they've learned in PDCs, which means permaculture design course, and putting it to the test economically. How can it be designed in a way where it can make an income to support my family, pay my insurance, you know, keep the internet on, you know, all the things that, you know, don't get factored in oftentimes when you start to think of living in today's day and age. And we've put together this incredible team, some of our family as well. We found, and this is kind of a longer story, or a little bit, you know, it goes a little bit back, but in 2008, we had a woman contact us, a friend, a really, really sweet friend who said, you know what, it was the summer of 2008, and she said, I feel really weird about the stock market, and her family had a lot of money in the stock market, and she said, I feel like it just needs to get out, and, you know, the money needs to get out and actually get into natural capital, something solid on the ground, but I don't know how to do it. And I said, well, let's start to look at this. And so we started to look at how that could happen. And then there was the crash in the fall of 2008, and they lost $20 million, like in just a couple of weeks. It was just gone. It was just like this, oh my God, you know, where did it go? You know, here was this money. And you think about in your own community, what could you do with $20 million? What could you build with $20 million? And you realize as a permaculturist, you do things so ecologically that with very little money, you can do a lot. And so as time went after the 2008 crash, this friend of mine and I came back to the discussion and we said, okay, so what do we do now with, you know, they had some money left over from that and they made a little bit of it back, but not very much. And we ended up forging an investment type of opportunity where we were bringing our skill sets to the table. We designed a whole prospectus and how this would work. We came up with a criteria of what would we need to see in a farm to make this the type of income that's coming in, the type of crop, what other unique circumstances on the land would make it possible for this to work financially where they could still make a return on their investment during these times. So what kind of return on investment could we create that made sense from an ecological standpoint? And looking and saying, okay, here's a monocrop soil extractive farm. How can we shift that so ecologically it makes sense? And so what happened was we were able to figure out how to do this. So one of the things that we were able to do was be able to look and all the accountants, because this family has this whole team of accountants that kind of manages their family trust, and they are very old school, very conservative, and the type of farm we bought was an avocado farm. So everything they based their projections on were based on this single monocrop of avocados. So 22 acres of this 49-acre farm is in avocados. They were blown away by all of the other enterprises that we could work into that actually reduced the expenses of the avocados by doing soil building. So, you know, just taking and mulching the 22 acres, we could reduce a huge input there, which was the water cost we could reduce by 30%. And then we start to build the soil microbiology, which as soon as you get the soil microbiology working for you, those are billions of free workers who are working for you, or trillions of free workers that are working for you, that help you to balance your chemistry. So then you don't have all of the inputs that come to, you know, make the chemistry work for those trees because the microbiology is doing it. Then, of course, in a monocrop farm, there's not understory plants. So we're looking and saying, okay, what guilds could we create within an avocado as our main plant? What guilds that we could support the avocados in being healthier and help us retain moisture and reduce Phytophthora, which is a root rot? And we started to realize that we could do understory ginger, understory coffee, and creating additional incomes within that. But that wasn't it either. I feel like I'm doing a commercial, an infomercial. But the other thing we found was that we would then run chicken tractors through the system, where a lot of the integrated pest management could be handled through chickens working through the leaf litter, and as well as creating an egg yield, which is a business that we're creating out of that using eggmobiles moving through our orchards. And so on and on, we added these other yields that were actually reducing our inputs for the overall operation. And then, of course, diversifying and creating soil building. And that's, you know, that's just a sliver of it. We have a lot of other enterprises that were starting up with that. And so when their accountants actually saw that, they were pretty astonished, because they're used to working with farmers who you basically say, what crop are you? And everything's based, all the finances, on one crop, which is just insanity to have. There's no way to make a profit, I believe, in a single crop farm that's not going to eventually put you into debt or subsidy. You have to get subsidies. You know, I don't want to be a farmer that's on welfare. You know, when I talk to some of the big farmers that are around in different parts of the world, but especially in America, I say, you know, I refuse to take welfare as a farmer. And they're like, what are you talking about? It's like, well, subsidies is welfare. Basically, you are drawing, you know, it's costing you more to do what you're doing. And then you get a subsidy. And that basically means you're getting a welfare check. I said, you know, I don't want to do that. And they're like, you know, especially the more conservative they are, well, that's not welfare. You know, I'm like, well, it is welfare. You know, it's coming from the government pool and you're being helped along so that you can make it. And I said, you know, just like a welfare check is, you know, sometimes people do need that. But I said, I'm not going to live my life where I'm relying on that every single year. I said, that's not fair. You know, it's like stealing from your grandchildren to feed yourself. And that doesn't feel right.
You want to be in a place where you're not borrowing money in the spring to buy seed to plant the crop for the year to then sell that crop at numbers that the accountants can run to then pay back that loan for the seed and then be left with what you're left with. You want to be profitable throughout the entire process.
And having diversity of enterprises built into your system, so you have integrated functions within your system, you're finding places where symbiotic micro-enterprises feed each other and then create a more stable and resilient financial system, but also ecological system. You know, this system, if you have a bad year with avocados, we're not devastated because we have these other micro-enterprises that are still working. And we're reducing inputs and we're having to be less in debt because of that. And I feel like that's, you know, I don't know why more farmers don't see it. And I think it, for me, when I started to ask that question, why are not more farmers switching from the monocrop model? And I realized that there's not enough demonstrations, that we need to show it in every ecological, you know, every watershed needs its examples of it. And I feel like that's important for us, not to just have the education center, which is Quail Springs, but to actually have a for-profit model of us taking a monocrop farm and turning it into something that is a community resource, an ecological resource, but also an economic resource that creates food sovereignty and stability for the community in which we dwell. So much of our local food primary production and primary processing systems in many, many communities around America have been dismantled for more centralized systems. And so it's really important that we start to look at strategies to create food resiliencies in our community. And so if we can find an economic model where in this community here, there's a lot of foundations that give money. You get grants. I don't know if you've worked with nonprofits before, Scott, but that's kind of the modus operandi. You go and you get a grant and then you do something that benefits the community. And what I keep telling people is that we need to not go after the grant money. We need to go for the principal money. That these foundations have, the local community foundation here has $200 million in the stock market and in real estate and in mostly the stock market though. And, you know, mutual funds and all, you know, all sorts of different things that they have their money invested in. And I think rather than fighting over the yields that come from a diminishing stock market system, which we're really in a tenuous place. If you start to look at a lot of conservative people who are forecasting, you know, the economies around the world over the next years, it's not looking pretty. We need to say, let's use that money now as a resource to try to change ecologies in our communities in a way that they can still make a return on their investment. And I think that's when we're going to start getting traction, where we're going to stop talking about just 30 backyards that are doing permaculture in this community to, you know, we've got 30,000 acres in this community in permaculture production that's creating food resiliency and stability here. And we did it all with money that was, we took out of the stock market in unethical, you know, oftentimes unethical investments and turned it into something local and resilient. It's kind of the slow money movement that Woody Tosh talks a lot about building fertility with our current economic resources.
One of the things about the permaculture model is that it tends to be a high labor, low tech approach, that it's not mechanized. And when I do a back of the envelope equation to kind of figure out the number of people who would have to be farming in order to make these kind of systems work, the numbers increase a lot. And I was wondering, how are you going to be handling the labor on the project that you're doing? Is that going to be a lot of hands-on? Are there portions of it that are going to be mechanized to make it work?
It's a very good and valid question, and it's one that I think everybody needs to ask, is that you have to look first at where is mechanization used. And when you see a lot of the systems where mechanization is needed to be profitable, it has to do with being, one, an export crop. So that's very few systems that need that scale of agriculture have to do with actually feeding your local community. To give you an example, we have Whole Foods, who is a market here in the U.S. that does natural foods, has a carrot farm, or they contract with people that grow carrots right outside of Quail Springs. They have 200 acres of carrots there that are huge mechanized process. They have 80 truckloads of fertilizer have to be brought in every year from, you know, almost 100 miles away. 80 truckloads drive up there. They pump 1,200 gallons a minute, 24 hours a day in a desert environment where they're overdrafting their aquifer, but they produce about 40 tons of carrots per acre. And all of those carrots, if you go to the farmer who's right there, who leases the land, because he can no longer afford to work on that scale because the cost of all the equipment and the pumping and all of that is just too costly. So it ended up pushing the local farmer out, so that the only option they had was to lease the land to this big multinational agricultural group to grow carrots for Whole Foods. And so what happens is that mechanization is super effective in creating export crop, but nobody in that community is going to be able to survive off that farm. There's no diversity in it. There's no, like, the farmer there drives 70 miles to a market to get his food. It's just insane. So when you start to look at a model that's a small farm, you have to look at, first off, where can you use mechanization? Where is appropriate technology? Does it make sense for a smaller operation? And there are places where that is. Like, there are some aspects of what we're doing that are, you know, we're actually pulling our egg mobiles, which are on trailers with small mechanized, like little mule quad system that can pull them through the orchard. So we're using mechanization, but in a place where it has a lot of leverage. And then what we do is we look and we say, okay, here in this 49 acres, how can we involve people in different enterprises where they're a part owner in the enterprise, even though they don't own the farm? So one of the things that happens, like on this new farm, is there was an old abandoned creamery that made goat cheese, a Chev making creamery that has all the equipment in. It was licensed 10 years ago, and we're going to start that up. But what we're doing is that several people that are involved are actually coming in like it's a micro enterprise on that farm, and the farm will share the profits, but they will too. So we're not just going and hiring everybody. The people are attending the avocado orchard and adding in the other layers of the understory have vestment in it. So they are also getting percentages of the profit, so that there's a lot of different way than being just a laborer on a farm, which is what the Western ag is really, the model is set up on, is that, you know, we're almost dependent upon a labor force that doesn't exist in America anymore, because it's all coming from south of the border mostly. And it's something where we're saying, well, no, let's incentivize this. Let's make it so that students who are, you know, going to college actually want to come back and work a farm job and create a micro enterprise that's selling directly to the consumer. So that's where the average farm in America sells to a wholesaler and basically makes 10 cents on the dollar. So if you can direct market, the most successful farms in America sell their products directly to the consumer. So you have to look and then say, well, that means I have to have a relationship with my community, because one, you're not going to be selling. You can't have a relationship with someone that's 3,000 miles away. You have to have it where it's local. So looking and saying, wow, this is actually a relationship built business that is direct marketed. And if you can do that, you have another 90% potential food dollar that you can harvest as a farmer. And so we've built the whole business model based on that. So we're, you know, one of the ways we can immediately harvest more money from this system is that we start to develop relationships with our avocados, both with added value making avocado oils, but also direct marketing to consumers right in our own area. And rather, because right now all the numbers were based on wholesale. So the labor ends up becoming something where, yeah, we do have some people hired that come in and they're working, and it's a ground level job, but we do have people within each system who are vested in it that are like, they really want to see it through because they have a percentage of profit. And so the other aspect of that that delves into the community aspect of permaculture is that, can you also give a place to stay, a place to live as a part of that? That's a place where you start to get into a lot of political and regulatory issues. But like this particular farm has 4 legal living situations, but we can actually add more to it because we know how to hide a yurt in the understory of an oak tree. You know, we've done, you know, where we're looking and saying, you know, we can have more people there that can actually live on the land, because that's becoming one of the difficult things for a lot of people, is paying rent and paying mortgage, where they're spending more and more money, you know, giving money to banks. There's a lot of strategies there. It's a huge question. And it's one of those things where I want to start to write some articles around what we're learning as we go through the process.
Well, I certainly look forward to reading that. I look at what you're doing and I think about Joel Saladin's book. I believe it's his, that Everything I Want to Do Is Illegal.
Yeah. He's very inspirational that way.
I look at the general model that you're building. I've been reading through Peter Bain's The Permaculture Handbook.
Yeah.
And a lot of his work discusses that idea of a garden farm being worked by people who are local to their community, selling back to their community, and showing that it's possible to make a middle-class wage by doing so. And what you're doing, I see that you're getting buy-in from the people who are working for you by giving them a share so that they're vested in it. But you also get a buy-in then from your customers, because you're making products that they want to buy in the local community. They know who you are and can be actively involved.
And, you know, it goes back to the storytelling, is that it comes full circle, where people end up then buying into the story and linking their story to a story that makes sense for the society around them, the ecology around them, and the economics around them. I mean, when you go and you make a statement every time you buy a carrot that comes from that farm out where I'm at, you buy it in Oklahoma at a Whole Foods, you buy a carrot there, you're sending a statement out into the world saying, I am supporting extractive agriculture. And a lot of times people don't make a different statement because there's not the opportunity to. They don't know how to grow the carrot, or they don't have conditions where carrots grow well. So you have to decide, do I still want a carrot? Or you have someone locally that you inspire by saying, I'm going to give you money to grow good carrots in an ethical way, and in a diverse way on a farm that makes sense, that doesn't destroy our local economy. Because when you start to give it to Whole Foods for that carrot that comes from all the way out here, you know, basically that money leaves your community immediately. And if you can give it to somebody locally, that money will cycle locally. That's something that we have to rethink bioregional you know, stabilization has to do with how we purchase things and also how we grow things. And so our hopeful, like, we have some big lofty goals with this, because this is just the very first thing. We envision having many, many farms in this area that are working under this investment model. And I've got investors waiting in the wings to seeing how this first one goes. And I know other people in other communities can use a similar model, because people really are feeling the instability of being a part of basically suckling from a globalized system where they have absolutely no control and everything is dictated away from their community. That is tenuous. And does that make sense? It's not pragmatic. And the thing is that I don't, you know, if you call yourself a conservative or a liberal, it doesn't matter. It's not pragmatic to not have local, stable food and water systems. You basically will be shooting your grandchildren in the foot, because we're thinking from this everything based on economy of a globalized economy. And we just, it's why I have such a big belief in, like, the transition town movement is so important right now, because we have to strategize as communities how we're going to bring back a lot of our stability through local small farms. And this is one financial model that I believe can work all over the place. And, you know, you can be a really adept designer and farmer on the ground and have some creative stuff, and you don't need to have money. I mean, I'm not a rich person. I don't have a lot of money myself, but I own so many acres of land through these endeavors that we're doing that took not a penny of money. I didn't, you know, no money down, so to speak. But they're invested in by people who say, I believe in this, rather than it being just a bank saying, if you mess up, this is going to cost you. It's like, no, there's people wanting to make change. So that's where the storytelling comes in, is that you then can share a story with your community and show that there are some viable options for this. And the more of these that pop up, the more they can be referred to. Right now, I refer to Joel Salatin a lot because he has one of the most financially viable farms in America. And it's not from education. It's from his farming methods, which is why he's so popular, you know?
He's one of the people who's been a pioneer who shows that you can do this, you can make it work.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I've been inspired a lot by his work. And I feel that every community is going to do it differently. You can't franchise it. You can't, like, say, this is what I'm going to do here, because every climate, every situation is going to be different. What you have to do is have awareness and then design for that, you know, design for what you're seeing in your area. What is viable for here? What's the market here? What's the constituency you're going to be serving, and what are their needs, and how do you meet them where they are? Maybe it's not your ideal, but it's like the step in place, you have to meet the pattern that's existing. Right now, you go to Trader Joe's, like in Santa Barbara County, only 5% of the food dollar stays in Santa Barbara County. 95% leaves. And Santa Barbara is considered very, very progressive. And yet 5%? So basically, rather than looking at it at 5% as a permaculturist, you say, wow, there's a 95% food dollar opportunity out there for me. That if you can work with the patterns of how people are spending that 95% of their food dollar, and you can harmonize with that, you can start to gather money that isn't even encroaching on the other small farms. What you're doing is you want to open up more markets so all the small farms do better. How do you cooperate to create, help people's buying habits shift, or where you offer it in a way that meets their buying habits now? And that's the challenge right now, is to look at the problem as a solution. And we can't just say, oh, you know, everybody needs to grow their own garden, because that's not the pattern right now. The pattern is that people don't know they don't know what the hell to do with a eggplant if it comes right out of their garden. They don't know how to turn tomatoes and basil and garlic into a sauce. It's crazy. I meet people who don't know that. They just know how to buy the can. And it's like, how can we become a part of that change? Because that is where you're going to get the most ecological traction out there, is when you start to see people really making big changes around how they work with their food. And if you do it in a way that's also socially equitable and builds more resiliency socially, locally, it's a win-win. I'm so excited about it, and I'll keep you informed of how it all goes, because we're literally closing escrow in 2 days and getting the keys to the ranch.
And this will probably go up 2 days after you close escrow, so we'll be speaking about this as a past event, and I'll keep my fingers crossed that everything goes perfectly for you.
Thanks.
And I thank you, though, for mentioning that we need to find our own models, because where I'm at, in the urban environment, one of our big issues is the food desert. and access to quality food for many people within my local community is very difficult.
Yeah.
And one of the local nonprofits is actually working on building some urban farms that will then be farm stands in the city that are in the kind of places where people, when you mention that you're in that neighborhood, they kind of shudder and they go, I can't believe you would go there. And it's making a difference for them.
You know, a town to watch, Scott, is Oakland. A city to watch. Oakland, where are you located?
I'm outside of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
Okay. You've heard of Oakland, California?
Oh, yeah.
There is some incredible organizations and kind of, I call them cultural creative people, who are looking and designing systems of food resiliency and health for inner city environments where you don't get Whole Foods markets, you know what I mean? They're people who are bringing food in on mobile trucks, doing like mobile guerrilla farm stands, you know, within the city so people can have access to organics, because it's like there's not even a opportunity for most people in a lot of those environments to even have the choice, you know? It's like the choice isn't even there. And the food, and you see it in like the instance of diabetes is high and all this, and they're doing some incredible things. There's organizations there. There's like one group, I just did some training with two of their students, came down for our, we have a program at Quail Springs called Sustainable Vocations, which is a 18-day permaculture design course where we take permaculture and then bring it into a vocational setting. Like, how do you convert that into applying permaculture as part of your vocation? And it's been an amazing course that we do. And we had two students from Oakland who work with this group called Planting Justice. And they are amazing because they work with gang members within the city limits in very urban inner city Oakland. And they're starting to look at every free space there and getting gang members to actually start to grow food rather than to subsist on drug interactions and violence. And they're saying they're seeing the members that actually, the people from the gangs that they're actually starting to grow food with, they're actually leaving the gangs. They're getting less violent. There's all this great data that's coming out of it. But what the repercussion of it is they're starting to build some local food systems for places that haven't had it. And so they share their food in the neighborhoods in which they're growing it. Rather than being this violent influence in their neighborhood, they're becoming gardeners, and they're amazing. You know, they're just like, you know, they speak the language of everybody in that area, and they're saying, you know, come on, bro, we got to grow food, not drugs, you know, we've got to. And they're not like preaching it, they're doing it, you know, they're there, and then they're giving food out to people locally. And it's just really, I feel like there's that, but then there's also, you know, really creative ways to blend local farming, like inner city farming, like you see in places like Cuba, and you're starting to see in Chicago and Detroit, these inner city farms starting to develop on rooftops. And we are such creative beings, and we have such a huge, massive amount of change that is happening right now. We are at so many tipping points around the world that we need to come together with that creativity, because I know we have it in us to make the changes, but we need to not just say it can happen on the farm or in the backyard or in the city. It's got to be this massive cooperative effort of diverse responses to the changing times that we're in, because if we don't do that, our great grandchildren aren't going to have a chance. I mean, you know, humanity is at the tipping point of being, maybe in the first time in history, we may have self-selected ourselves out of the gene pool. And I really hope that we can inspire enough people to use their creativity in ways that really create ecological and social equitability.
Well, as long as you continue to do your work, I'll continue to do mine, and we'll get that word out there and see what change we can bring.
Yeah, we'll do a virtual handshake on it, Scott.
You've got that. Not a problem.
Good.
I've had you here for about an hour, and I'm looking over everything we've covered, and it's a lot.
Yeah.
And I certainly want to have you back sometime. There's some other things that you're working on that I'd like to talk to you more about.
Okay.
And to find out how your other project is going.
Yes, please.
As for this conversation, is there anything else that you'd like to add before I thank you for your time?
I really feel like if you're listening to this and you're saying, oh, well, is a permaculture course for me, I really highly recommend that you get the one. I feel like it's basic training for living in the 21st century in a way that actually makes sense. And it gives you some basic skills to whether you're working in an accounting firm on Wall Street to being a farmer in the Midwest, that there are skills that you could take back to what you're doing that will better your life. It'll better the way you see things. I mean, honestly, you can never go to a PDC or permaculture design course and come out looking at the world the same, because what it does is it awakens you to the patterns that you're in. And it helps you to realize that you are never disconnected from nature, no matter where you live. You literally are a part of an intricate web of life that you can either negatively affect by being completely unconscious of your connection, or you can be conscious of your connection to that web of life around you and make huge positive ripples through the world. And I really feel that it's an important training for everyone, and you won't waste your time doing that. The other thing is just to for people to really remember that their next best step towards a sustainable lifestyle, towards a sustainable way of living, is going to be different from every single person around them. Every one of us, our next best step is different. And so recognizing what that is for you and not putting down others around you who maybe you see that they're not making enough of a step or whatever in your eyes, is recognizing that what we have to do is help each other make the next step. And then from there, you make the next step, and there you make the next step. So everybody, it's different. And I realize that there's a lot of weight on people's shoulders where they don't want to even move at all because it seems like they have to do too much to get there. It's like, no, just make one step. Buy a carrot from a local farmer and find out, you know, how do they grow it? Talk to them. See what their process is. Are they a diversity farm? Are they using integrated pest management processes? Are they nice people who are family friendly? Are they, you know what I mean? Just make a choice that has to do with one thing that you're doing in your life. Take one thing and say, I'm going to make a difference here, and I'm going to buy a carrot that's equitable, so that when I eat this carrot, I'm actually eating a story that feeds the world rather than steals from it.
Thank you, Warren, for your wisdom and your time. This has been a great interview, and I've really enjoyed this time with you.
Thank you, Scott. I look forward to the next time we get a talk, and thank you for the work you're doing.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Thank you for joining me for another interview. If you have comments or questions about this or any other episode, go to thepermaculturepodcast.com and leave a message or send me an email. That address is show@thepermaculturepodcast.com. Until the next time, take care of yourself, the Earth, and each other.